Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are talking a little bit about the arts, a little bit about activism, and a little bit about how everything is connected, whether you want to know so or not. Someone who lives his life disconnected, off the grid, except for his Twitter conversations, which, you know, I would advise you to mute. Martin, how are you keeping?
Not too bad, Tony. How are you? Did you go out for your jog, get your T-shirt off this morning?
I had a lovely run out in the freezing cold at Talca Valley Park in Finglas this morning while you were still in the scratcher. And I tell you, it was Baltic cold and soaking wet, but wouldn't do without it. Reminder to listeners, no ads, no sponsors, no nothing. We just rely on you guys. So it is purely patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's the price of a cup of coffee every month, but it's what keeps us going. And there's a lot of content coming your way and some fantastic things coming. Speaking of fantastic guests, we are thrilled to be joined by actor and activist, I think it's fair to call him, Liam Cunningham. Liam, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
It's a pleasure to see us all, lads. Pleasure to see the Perrys.
Liam, I suppose the genesis of this was you were online talking about an extraordinary documentary. There's no two ways to put it. I think it's £3 it cost me on YouTube to watch it, called Collective, and it's well worth it, folks. I can't stress how much it was about a fire in a nightclub in Bucharest and how that actually showed or put a microscope under events that took place not just on the night but actually after the events. Liam, do you want to just give us a quick thing why you were promoting that, why you thought it was such an exceptional thing in the context of today, I suppose?
Well, it's very much about today, and not only that, it's very close to home. Anybody that's aware of the Stardust tragedy in Dublin, this will resonate with them. And that's in microcosm of our little city. My sister was in the Stardust, and I should have been there that night. I found my sister and our mate in Jervis Street when it used to be a hospital. So watching this from the get-go, the hair went up on the back of my neck. And basically what you have is a nightclub that were listening to some rotten death metal or something they were listening to. I can't remember what it was. Anyway, there's an appalling fire that takes off very, very similarly to what happened in the Stardust. There was a number of people, young people, heavy rockers and goths and all those delightful people who died. The fire doors were locked and blocked, same as what happened here. And then the real story, shall we say, apart from that initial tragedy, happened in the hospital when I don't know what I used the figures there, but there's another 39, I think, or 37 or something like that, died having survived the fire. And they died of essentially it's something like MRSA, you know, the bug, that the hospital bug that, yeah, that has hurt a lot of people around the world. And what happened was they discovered that the disinfectants that were being used were being watered down to the point that they were useless. And because of governmental and bureaucratic corruption, which was basically the fault of the manufacturer, and he was in cahoots with various people. But one of the things that's very, very, very interesting about it, apart from observing firsthand that if you sit back and allow corruption to happen, this is what happens. What was interesting from a journalistic point of view was that it wasn't, the story was exposed not by your equivalent of the New York Times or the Irish Times or any of the mainstream newspapers. It was discovered by a magazine or a newspaper called the Sports Gazette. So it was a fucking sports paper, which is shameful to people who are supposed to be journalists, who are supposed to be doing their job and evidently aren't. And these wonderful people, specifically at the top, this lady and this guy, the editor and his second in command, and they just wouldn't let the story go. And they exposed a huge amount. And it's incredibly dramatic. There's no voiceover or anything of your normal documentary. It's just kind of fly on the wall stuff. And to just see the barefaced disregard for people and the state services and all that sort of stuff. And it's an extraordinary documentary.
It had a lot of what happened in the Stardust, in that after the initial fire, there was protests.
Yep.
And people took to the streets. And even if you watch the video, you can see that flashover that happened in the Stardust, that exact same thing.
The ceiling went up.
Yeah, but it was afterwards then that when the people started dying in hospital, people started asking questions. And then they took to the streets yet again. Yeah. Because it was a double disaster. It was a disaster on top of a disaster.
Yeah.
And I think they found out that the antibacterials or the disinfectants they were using were watered down to maybe 10% of what they needed to be.
Totally ineffective.
Yeah, absolutely. But the bigger story was that the corruption was so endemic.
Yeah.
It's right up the chain. And people had bribed their way into positions in the hospitals and into the authorities. And at the end of it, I actually found it disappointing that there was no way to fix it. The only way to fix it was to scrap the whole thing. But to do that, you're going to affect even more people. So it was simply unfixable.
Yeah. Well, it's never unfixable. It's difficult. You could see the job that the new Minister of Health, when they brought in, which was really interesting, because the first guy that comes on is just talking complete and utter shite. Just spin shite, the same shite we put up with here. But when he goes and the new guy comes in, the new guy's was really impressive. And you could tell immediately before you saw anything that he said, the access he allowed in real time, him making decisions, him getting information, him meeting survivors, and him trying to make good, and the barriers that he comes up against. But it was that sort of stuff was really interesting, because you're in the room with him when he's doing all that. They're not hiding behind spin doctors or rather expensive advisors and consultants, spin consultants. So it was really interesting to watch them trying to destroy a guy whose intentions were pure, really.
Yeah, I think, Liam, though, that's a really crucial point you make. And when you said when the echoes of it with our own history, but also, of course, in a modern context, the idea that, because if you watch the documentary, it is literally fly on the wall stuff. It's almost over his shoulder a lot of the time. Like, the camera is over this man's shoulder and you're going through these experiences. And that's what really is profound about it. But I suppose when we see the last 12 months from an Irish context, in terms of, you know, this time last year, we were in the midst of a general election campaign, and we were, you know, we were looking into it. And I recall the op-eds from political editors telling us, you know, well, it's between Micheál or Leo to be Taoiseach, you know, forget about any alternative. And I got it, you know, I called it editorializing at the time. I call it editorializing now. I've lost friendships over this, but we still see it in, I'm not saying that, I'm not comparing like for like, but we do see situations today where schools have had issues where the hand sanitizer couldn't be used because it wasn't fit for purpose.
Yeah.
These have real life implications in the real world now. And someone with your activism background, you must look at it and see the join the dots and be absolutely furious.
Yeah. There is some of that. I actually, to be honest with you, I spend a lot of time as you know, probably from my Twitter feed, giving out about, the two sides of the political coin here, as it used to be, with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. I felt there's probably more to do with me being 125 than anything else. Is that I gave them a bit of leeway. It was unprecedented. We've never had to put up with it. So there was going to be stumbles along the way. And I have to say, and I'll preface this by saying, I've actually never voted for Sinn Féin. So I'm certainly not a spokesman for them. But I had a huge amount of respect, because the easiest thing in the world to do would be to dump on Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and the Greens at the early stage of this, because they were sitting ducks with a pandemic, the whole lot. And I thought initially the reaction was really good, going straight for the PUP payment, the whole lot, which is not exactly generous of them, because they obviously know their history. Is that what there's statistics you can look up here. When you've got social unrest, the vast majority of the time, it's because people lose trust in their government. Not because of anything else. It's because the government has basically fucked up. So this had all the ingredients for revolution. So that's one of the main reasons. It wasn't the goodness of their heart that they did the PUP. It was to keep the masses quiet, which in a way is fair enough. People had to put food on the table and they were asked not to work. Employers weren't going to be able to pay, especially in the hospitality, retail, all that sort of stuff. I get all that. As it goes on, I definitely think that obviously business and the business lobbyists got much too much say. And that's easily proven. This is not an opinion. You've only to look at New Zealand. You've only to look at Australia, and to see that the choices that we made gave too much credence to people with money, and it just shows up how much of an influence business has in the two main parties. However, you were talking about the last election. What they have done, the stupid thing that they've done, is certainly with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, is teaming up together, having had the reins for 100 years. And the biggest mistake they made was to make Sinn Féin the official opposition. That's basically what they did when they formed the coalition. I think that's pretty obvious, which gave them credibility, gave them funds, gave them all sorts of things. And I have very little doubt that our next government is going to see a change of 100 years. A new century of Irish politics, I would imagine. Battering disaster.
I don't think we're alone in that either. I think if you look at the States and you look at the UK and wider Europe, the pandemic is going to cause political upheaval right across the world. It's not just Ireland. Something like this happens, and we've seen really and truly what we can say is that neoliberalism has failed to tackle the pandemic. It's a broken model. It can't work.
No, it can't work.
In a situation like this, it's a broken model. So I think we're going to see post-pandemic, we'll see a lot of political agitation right across the world. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's a very good thing.
Yeah, me too.
I particularly think that we can see where Ireland fell down coming up to Christmas. We can see where there was influence exerted and we were told that it was worth the risk. Well, over 1,000 people have died since.
Yeah. No, so, I have that round the house. My missus now is going, what the fuck did I do? We're opening over Christmas. Look what's happening. And at the beginning of whatever it was, late October, November, when we went into the lockdown, the plan at the time, and again, I don't defend these guys a huge amount, the people in government now. The plan was, let's have a full lockdown and try and have Christmas. That was attempted and backfired hugely. And we're suffering for it now, and there's deaths because of it, and it's rampant in the care homes and all that sort of thing. But that was the plan. There was no mystery here with this. It was a dangerous thing to do, and as you say, it was influenced by people wanting to open up and cash in on the Christmas period. I think that was tempered with a bit of nostalgia and let's get the families together and all that sort of thing. So I think the decision was swayed. We obviously should have now. Hindsight's a wonderful fucking thing. It was a really bad decision, but at the time, there was only a few people were roaring about it, don't do it, because people wanted Christmas. I wanted Christmas. Everybody wanted a Christmas as payment for breaking your bollocks for the 5 or 6 weeks that we had. I kind of get that. Again, that's the easy target thing. It's very easy in hindsight to kind of say we shouldn't have done it. Yeah, the figures now tell us that. However, that rise, that fucking vertical rise, wasn't really expected. So I wouldn't horse them over that.
It's not that it wasn't expected. It was that the worst case scenario wasn't planned for, Liam.
Yeah, that's fair to hear. Because we don't have a proper fucking health service because it's been gutted.
And I suppose when you come down to it, if we digest this all the way back to this time last year when we were coming through the general election cycle, as I said, ended up with a caretaker government and them getting credit for being perceived to have handled the first wave of the pandemic well. The funny part about that was there was a touch of me looking at that going, are we actually rewarding the lad who maybe, you know, wrecked the gaff for eventually calling the police? And, you know, 10 years of government, and not just 10 years of the previous Fine Gael government, but decades of doing things in terms of how we've done things around housing and made our housing system a housing market and, you know, and forced more people out of home ownership than ever in the history of the state, forced more children into homeless than ever in the history of the state. And then we're going, well, they had a good 3 months that they did what the doctors told them to do. So, you know, I don't want, and like you, I don't want to go down the road of bashing them for when it's just too easy, because we actually have, the wolf is still at the door. There are still people dying far too frequently. But if I can go back to the genesis of this conversation around the documentary, the parts that the media play in how this is portrayed to the Irish, that to the people in the story, in the actual true story of the Collective Nightclub, it also rings true to me so often today when I see how we are told, you know, here, this is the agenda. You know, we're already being told that and we'll have to start paying this back again at some stage. Austerity is necessary, and all this sort of, and we just know that that's not true.
No, it's not true. No, I think they're hanging, the austerity argument has basically gone out the window. It doesn't work, and I mean, you only look at places like Portugal, which are economically going through the roof here, and they basically said goodbye to austerity, and they started investing heavily. It's ridiculous to have austerity now with interest rates so low. It's basically almost free money. When you're taking your loans or whatever, they'll have to be paid back, but the interest is minimal. It's absolutely minimal, and it's a time for investment, especially when this is not going to be the rain on everyone's parade. This is not going to be the last pandemic where we're described by somebody in the World Health Organization as that human beings are an infestation on the planet, as in there are too many of us. We are a hugely successful species, and during that time, nature has a way of trying to thin it out, which is an awful thing to say, because we're all, you know, capable of love and art and all sorts of beautiful things as human beings. So we have to be incredibly careful, and the only way to do that is to have a healthy health service and plans in place when this crap comes around again. And beds for the sick, and you know, what about the amount of people that have not been talked about that are on, the cancer operations, car crashes, heart attacks, all that sort of stuff, which are being unprioritized now because of lack of bed space and all that sort of stuff. It's appalling what the health service has been allowed to become. They just wanted to get away with as little investment as they possibly could.
Sorry, Martin, I know you want to come in, but let's make the point to listeners. Go listen to our podcast from the weekend with Dr. Marie Casey, because she makes the point around public health that at the end of this, and there will be an end of this, the recovery phase for society, for the health service, and for us as a people is going to be huge. The cost to that, where she said there are people now who are working with her, who are colleagues, who will, when this all leaves them, will probably just wash out of the system because they can't deal with it. Sorry, Martin, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, Liam, because you're in the arts, and I wanted to ask, you know, the pub payment, artists they have an influence beyond their size, and politicians love to have an arm around an actor or an artist and to use your agency.
Bathe in the glow of artistic success.
They want your political capital, Liam.
Yeah. But, and we have to play a dangerous game as well, because we need state investment, especially for a country our size, when it's very difficult to make something as expensive as a movie and get the money back or even cover your arse. When you think, you know, the entire population of Ireland is about a third of the population of Greater London, it's very hard to to just get the money back on this invest. So we're very much reliant on state investment. And it's incredibly important. It's, you know, your movies, your TV, your plays, your music are your calling card to the world about who you are as a nation. And if you don't want to do that, it's like the fella said, the most cost effective form of art is no art.
When artists flex their muscles, the government moved very, very quickly to make sure that they boxed artists off with a kind of a basic payment to allow them in on the pub, in that your power was very apparent in that they did not want to go up against artists. I thought that was very telling.
Well, it always happens. It's why Charlie Hyde introduced the artist exemption, which actors were never entitled to. There's a misnomer about it that it's all over you actors on your tax-free earnings and all that. I was never fucking tax-free. For this reason, the government never gave actors any tax relief because they only gave tax relief to creative artists. And actors were never considered creative, believe it or not, were regarded as interpretive.
I know.
We get a script, and because we're not... Apparently, we're just speaking. We're just moving our mouths and speaking the words.
I know someone predominantly Liam, whose day job was comedy, and wrote a successful book, and was told there's no artist exemption on the book because you're a comedian. I just thought that was that's a joke. You know that is insane. Like I know, and again, not personalizing it, but Ryan Tuberty got an exemption on his JFK book.
What's his name? John Simpson, the BBC reporter, had a gaffe in Cork, and when he was writing his books, he got artist exemption for writing his books. Fellas here got artist exemption for writing commercials for washing powder, while actors were earning 200 quid a week doing breaking up bollocks doing Shakespeare in little theatres and had to pay full tax on that.
It tells you why a lot of artists don't stay. A lot of actors don't stay in Ireland. I mean, why would they stay in Ireland when that's the regime? But just to spread it out a little further, you're a big believer in universal basic income and also universal services.
Yeah.
And you don't 100%. Think that you don't think that it should stop at artists. You think everybody should have a crack at this.
Yeah, I think Finland they've had a study, haven't they? They've started the UBI. And appears to be really successful, but of course the D4 dickheads will be saying, they'll be scratching a hole and investing in GameStop instead of buying food, it doesn't work like that. You create people who've got a couple of quid in their pocket; they're not scraping for their next sausage and fucking mash on Friday, and they have time to think. They have time to pursue an education. You'll always get people. There's people I know who are multimillionaires who are just scratching their hole all day, and they bring nothing to society either. But it's okay because daddy left them a load of money. Please, it's to deny people opportunity to pull themselves out of a tough existence is the responsibility of society. It's why we pay our taxes. We pay our taxes for health, for education, and for infrastructure and the public services. And if you start denying those, then where is my tax money going? Because that's what I pay my tax for.
And there is a perception, the media always flog the story that we're a high-tax country, but we're not really a high-tax country. What we are is a country where we pay tax and get very little return for it.
Yes, that's true. And also, I saw, now I don't know if this may have been from 2017, this... I'm trying to remember where the quote was, but is it 85% of our exports out of this country are by multinationals, i.e. pharma, Intel, whatever it may be, the Google, the social media crowd. So 85%, and in Denmark, which is similar, it's about 6 million. So there's only 15% is indigenous exports. Your Kerrygolds and your all that sort of stuff that are Irish. In Denmark, those statistics are almost exactly reversed.
It's the inverse.
15% of their exports are multinational, and 85% are indigenous.
We have
that's a bad condition this country is in.
Yeah, we've seen that throughout the course of the pandemic, Cowboy, where the state said we're factoring in this huge deficit that's going to hit us because of the pandemic, and it didn't hit us because the likes of the companies that we actually service. And Ireland. I call it tax evasion. The state calls it legalized tax avoidance, and that huge system was not impacted by the pandemic. Really, in fact, actually, we saw billionaires grow their growth by the same amount of damage. You know, I saw in one study, billionaires grew their wealth by as much in 3 months that they reckon it will take the rest of the world 14 years to crawl back. Yeah, so and we have to be honest about this. That is Ireland's place in the world quite right now. The EU has
it's a tax haven.
Yeah, we've been declared a tax haven by the EU ourselves. So it's very difficult for us to sit here and say that that's not what we do. However, doing that and not, Liam, as you put it, investing in health and investing in housing and investing in education just seems folly. I mean, like, invest in the arts. We have brilliant people. Why the hell aren't we like, you know, giving them the space to say, actually, you've got 6 months, go away and produce what you're going to produce, as opposed to come in here every 2 weeks and let me ask you what you're up to, you know?
Yeah. It's very strange. It's the halo effect that's very difficult to put on a spreadsheet. And I'll give you the example of what you're talking about with the Game of Thrones thing, right? Not that long ago, probably halfway through shooting, I obviously spent a lot of time up in Belfast. And I'd said this at I was asked to do a couple of just little talks for openings and premieres and all that sort of stuff with the North. I was walking out of the hotel, walking along Victoria Street or something like that. This American couple dived up, and as demonstrative as they are, they were screaming and shouting. And I said, what's the story? And they were obviously huge fans. And I said, what are you doing here? And they said, we're on a honeymoon. I said, you came to Belfast for your honeymoon? And he said, well, we met on watching Game of Thrones, and we kind of bonded over it, and we've gone through the whole lot, and it basically put us together, blah, blah, blah. And I remember saying to a load of Northerners, I said, that in itself, it's a nice story, but I said, what's more important is if you look back 10 or 15 years, if I'd have told people in Northern Ireland that there'd be Americans coming to Belfast on their honeymoon, you'd have laughed at me. And I said, there's a halo effect. Apart from the jobs, there's a whole swing away from the violence and the horror that was going on. And one of the benefits of that was when, you know, the peace dividend, as they used to call it, was something, the show was big and HBO coming up there. And it's the perception of the place. You cannot, I don't care how much money you have, if you haven't got things like movies been made, if you have, you know, big TV shows or whatever, that is beyond money, because you've changed perception by people around the world looking at it and finding out these beautiful places that were filmed in. And they have a different opinion of a place that very few people on the planet wanted to even visit. And that's one of the things that art is incredibly good at. It was the same, even years ago, I remember with Body Kiss Angel, when that was huge on BBC, there was a whole industry of coaches and tour buses and people, English people coming over and wanted to go down and see the village where it was done. And there's a ripple effect from TV shows and stuff that is there.
I heard Nicole Kidman tell Mark Maron on his podcast a couple of weeks ago that she was filming in Belfast, and she turned to her other half and she said, why don't we live here? And I thought, imagine hearing that in my lifetime. Yeah. You know, like,
yeah.
Like a Hollywood A-list actor telling, why don't I live in Belfast? You know,
it's insane. But that's how much that gorgeous place has travelled in the last while, and that sort of stuff is important. That's where art becomes important,
and it's important to recognise that as a country we punch way above our weight in the arts, way above our weight.
We have four Nobel Prize winners for literature which are we the only country, I think, that has that, I think. We punch way above our weight on serious stuff, on beautiful, you know. I mean, America does quantity incredibly well, and we do quality incredibly well. And you know, to let that stuff go, you just disappear. You internationally, culturally, people don't take you seriously. If you're regarded as contemplative and artistic and literary, there's respect that comes with that, international respect. You're not poo-pooed. And that's incredibly important.
Can I ask you, it's a different question now, but it talks about, so you, when you were on something like Game of Thrones, which was a global phenomenon, you chose to spend some of your cultural capital talking about the refugee crisis, that's a really admirable thing for someone to do. You know, when you're at the zenith, when you're riding the wave, then to turn around and say, "Yo, hold on, folks, I don't want to talk to you about what's going on here. I want to talk to you about something else."
Yeah,
has that perception, do you think, come with a cost to you as an actor, or is it something that you do again?
I never thought about it. It was a few jobs I had to turn down. I could have been driving a Ferrari, and I could have been talking on a much bigger iPad. I didn't think about it like that. I was a punk in the late 70s, and I moaned about injustice. And like we were saying earlier on, in my 20s, I was viewed as a rebel. When you hit your 50s, the same attitude is regarded as curmudgeonly.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be presented with an opportunity because of the temporary nature of celebrity and fame, I couldn't turn me back on it when I had a perfect opportunity to give out and to bring some eyes on the problems that these psychopaths in suits, or as we tend to call them, politicians, have wrought on places like Syria and in Africa as well. And to not bring attention to that would have been a crime. So I never quantified it as I could be spending this time doing a lot, filling up my current account. It wasn't the case of that. I discovered somebody was willing to listen to me, so I started roaring.
No, I just, and I mean, because we've seen it even in the last year under conditions whereby, you know, the EU acted shamefully, where the EU Parliament voted for, with Fine Gael's votes, by the way,
yeah.
The EPP.
Yeah, the four Fine Gael, yeah, Mairead McGuinness and all that gang.
Yeah,
they voted, right. Yeah. They
voted.
The vomit, yeah, they sided with the fascists in Europe.
They were cheering. The Fidesz were cheering that this was done, and I recall, and I'm not
shameful.
And Mairead McGuinness spoke about, you know, oh, we'll come back to the table really quickly with an alternative. Just the bill was flawed. We didn't want to create a pull factor. Pull factor. Yeah. How disgusting is that when you think about it in terms of, you know, what we think about human rights and our ability to move, our ability to be around and be referred to something that, you know, as you would put it earlier, some sort of spin doctor came up with the phrase, you know, this was a pull factor. I wasn't fleeing war, Liam. It was a pull factor.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's why the conflation, it's all very delicately handled. They don't want to separate migrant workers, which are, you know, if there's no jobs, that they're not allowed entrance, the same as everywhere in America, Australia, whatever it may be, and people fleeing from war, because it was shameful to stop people fleeing from war, a war that created by the West and produced refugees. And a lot of people, they don't like talking about it. During the Second World War, Syria took in a huge amount of refugees from Europe. I think it was like 60, 80,000 Poles, I think, were accepted. North Africa, huge amounts of refugees left Europe and went to North Africa. And as soon as they start coming the other way, we've no time for them, can't afford them, they shouldn't be here. It's the obscenity of doing that for people that are in trouble. At the moment, have a look at Bosnia. What's going on in Bosnia is appalling, between Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. and Serbia, and there's refugees out in the snow walking in the countryside looking for places. It's this disgusting, shameful behaviour. And not only that, but incredibly stupid. I'll give you an example of it. I was in South Sudan, nearly got myself in a bit of trouble. I was filming the last season of Game of Thrones, I think, at the time. I didn't tell them I was going over. It's a war zone, so they wouldn't have really liked me going. Could have been a bit tricky if I got killed over there. It'd be very difficult to finish the show. But on my first night in bed, there was gunshots just outside our little compound that we were staying in. They went, shite. I was actually more worried about the show. I'm going to tell it. How am I going to explain this if I'm killed? So that was tricky. But here's what's interesting. South Sudan is the newest country on the planet. Was it 2011? I think 2005 or 2011. Doesn't matter. They got their flag. It's a complicated place. There's about 12 million people. About 60 different languages, because there's 60 different tribes. They had the unfortunate luck of discovering high quality crude oil. So they have the resource course. They've also got the Nile running through the place. It's incredibly fertile. However, with the formulation of this, the warlords got involved. There was even an ex-Israeli general who was sanctioned by the US Treasury Department because he was selling weapons to both sides of the conflict. So here's the thing. So we've seen the Mediterranean. We've seen a lot of people coming from Libya who were workers, a lot of them in the oil industry from Somalia and Ethiopia and all that sort of stuff. There's 12 million people. If the international community allows South Sudan to become a failed state, and I asked this of the people that were involved, wonderfully, really clever people involved in the World Food Programme, United Nations. And I said, let me run something by here. Is this beyond the realms of possibility? I said, if this fails, and there was already famine, there was pockets of famine in this place, and there was no need for it. It's not a desert. It's just war had driven people. They couldn't grow their crops, blah, 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 harvest, any of that. I said, you've only got South Sudan, Sudan, Libya, and the Med. I said, is it beyond the realms of possibility of this, if these people can't feed, that they might start heading north? And they said, yeah, it's not out of the question. So it is within the interests. These people only needed a few billion. Mm. It was costed how much it would cost to save this, where the various parties would sit down at the table, an injection of money. That they've oil, it could be paid back, it could be the fucking loan. And they wanted to wash their hands of it with the possibility of a fucking disaster with 12 million people heading for Europe for sanctuary, for food, whatever. And it's easily sorted with a few quid, and they're still not doing it.
Yeah.
And it's the same in Libya. The reason they were lagging from Libya and hitting the Med is because the Americans, the English, and the Italians and French. Started to turn Libya into a failed state and caused the refugees. But of course, as the EU, it's just seen as a problem because people are coming over who aren't the same color as us trying to take our jobs.
We're in the centenary of anniversaries, and we think about, 1916 from an Irish point of view. But we also have to think about the Balfour Declaration, where we sat down and the English and the French and all, and they drew lines on maps that were arbitrary. I want this part, and we'll call that's Lebanon, that's this, and you mentioned Sudan and how there was South Sudan and Sudan, and there was a time where. Like I'm not speaking. It's fact. Bin Laden built roads in Sudan. He did more with his father's money than any of the others. Now, I absolutely the man. I abhor the man and everything. Stuff, yeah. But you understand how if what we deem to be the good guys, if they withdraw, something else fills the void. And this is what happens in these places. And eventually you end up as what you're referring to as failed states. So, yeah, absolutely. And the damage that's been done in the last, even under COVID, And myself and Martin have spoken to people around the world about this who are in so-called developing nations. They've dealt with COVID a lot better because they've got experience of bloody fear of hunger and plague and all of these things that they've had to deal with. And we in the West have been a disaster because we always lived under the premise that it can't happen to us. But just again, going back to it, it is really, really sad as an Irish person to not see, you know, because I remember the time Enda Kenny saying Ireland stands ready to do its part. And I think at the time, I think we agreed to take in, it was 15,000 people. And I don't think we broke 1,800 at the time.
Yeah, it's disgusting. And it's appalling. I went to all the shite that's going on in Greece at the minute. And I was in the camps in Greece and they were promised help. And I met Lesvos, where the big fire was, the Moira camp. When I met the mayor, I was incredibly impressed with him. He referred to refugees as our guests. And it, a huge tourist place, obviously, Lesvos. And when they started arriving, they had nowhere to go. And they were sleeping basically on the harbour walls and all that. And it ruined the tourist industry. You know what I mean? It'd be like Dingle, like the boats arriving in Dingle. It was just, and they were everywhere. And they were treated as refugees, as people in trouble and all that. And then the Greeks, with all their problems with their right-wing government and the corruption that was happening there, were promised help by the EU, which didn't show up. And this problem gets worse because we're not taking our responsibilities properly. One more, for instance. In Italy, and this is probably 2 years ago, 10,000 unaccompanied minors went missing. In other words, no idea where they are. They just fell through the net. In other words, with no state assistance or anything like that. So they just disappeared into the community. Now the problem is they've no family there. A lot of them are alone. A lot of them will be disregarded. What happens with that is they become prime material for people who want to exploit them. It doesn't take much for a 16, 15, 14-year-old to be shown a little kindness and a bowl of fucking rice. And within a month, somebody's saying, here, you need to strap this thing to you and go in there because these people didn't look after you and we've been feeding you. It's very easy to manipulate people, especially if younger people who haven't been had an education, who haven't been around, haven't had a stable life, and to see what the capability or the possibilities are from people who've been sidelined and not welcomed into a society when they're refugees fleeing war is a recipe for disaster. The small mindedness, the stupidity of not you know, putting in preventative measures to stop that happening. And they can't even do that. I mean, the organization, and there's a lot of people doing very good thing. I work with NGOs and I've seen extraordinary work that they've done. But on a governmental side, fucking hell, man. Some of it's depressing.
And you and I are kind of a generation, Liam, you know, we're pretty close in age. We've seen how much Dublin has improved since we were kids. And I mean the diversity in Dublin.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a much better place than it was when I was a kid because of the diversity that's in Dublin.
Yeah.
But I'm going to move on from that a bit. I'm going to ask you, in this COVID world, how are you coping with work? Are you getting much work done? Have you plans to get any more work done?
I'll tell you the work I'm doing. I'll tell you what you interrupted. I'm doing the hall stairs and landing, trying to get fucking 100 years of bastard and wallpaper. And I've me two sons in there trying to scrape it. That's how glamorous my life is. Yeah, I'm doing maintenance on me Ferrari in me gated community in Hollywood.
You guys can't see this, but Liam is actually on. He's got a three-piece suit on. He's
three-piece gold suit.
Yeah, he keeps talking about a hand-fitted Hugo Boss suit that doesn't fit, that he can't take the change.
And that million-euro watch is just absolutely spot on.
Yeah, I was going to go for the 2 million one, but it was a bit too big. Yeah,
too ostentatious.
Fucking hell!
So what does the future hold? Yeah,
it's very bizarre. I'm I'm incredibly lucky. And I suppose if you looked at it from a professional point of view, it's nothing short of a disaster. But from a personal point of view, and I'll give you reasons why. I don't have any of my kids. My youngest is 20, and he's a chef. So he's out of work. My other young fella got his, just at the end of 19, got his degree in computers and networks and all that sort of thing.
Congrats.
So he did works in offices, setting up networks and, you know, all that sort of stuff. That's gone fucking bang. And my eldest, my daughter, luckily enough, she's working from home. She's a video game designer and all that sort of thing, so she can work off a terminal here. She also lectures in Trinity College as well. The good news is that I have them all trapped. They can't go anywhere. So I've got, my eldest is like 28, 29 now, and my youngest is 20. So by right, they should be fleeing the nest, and they can't. So I've got time with them, you know, doing a bit of cooking together. As I say, we're decorating the gaff, and I'm getting to spend a bit of time that I probably shouldn't have with them. And I don't have me babies in school. I don't have to do homeschooling or any of that. I feel really sorry for people who've got fucking young kids. It's a nightmare. It's like my daughter said. Well, I said, they're all mad to get these schools open again. My daughter said, it's not the schools, Dad. It's fucking babysitting service. That's what they want, to stop parents killing their fucking kids. Which is kind of understandable psychologically. So there's a bit of that. So were I to complain about my particular situation, and I haven't claimed any PUP payment or anything like that. I had a couple of, I live very simply. As you can see, I'm trying to redecorate my little house in the north side. I did all right, not as well as you should have, our Game of Thrones, but I had a bit of a war chest, as every actor tries to have in case of fucking lean times, of which they're always lean times. And I've had to dig seriously into that. My little war chest is getting very small at the minute. But hopefully, realistically, I don't see myself going back to work before the end of summer. So, and that'll be, the last time I was in front of a camera was December 2019 in Italy. And I haven't been in front of a camera since then.
Liam, thanks for coming on and having this chat with us. It's always nice to chat to somebody who has a good worldview on stuff. You know, you get, and I think that's probably the profession too. You get to see beyond the borders of Ireland, which is good. It gives you
that lucky, very lucky.
So thank you so much for coming on and having this chat with us. We could probably chat for another hour, but you know, this is probably.
I'm going to get back to the world here.
We're saving you.
listeners, just be mindful. Liam only agreed to do this because we could get him out of a couple of hours of doing the. He said he had a wallpaper steamer in one hand and a scraper. Yeah, listen. Yeah. We also rely on you guys. So it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It really, I know people get sick having to ask for money. It's shit having to ask for money, but we have to, because we can't do it without a bit of support. So if you can, put your hand in your pocket, it's a price for a cup of coffee, helps us out. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.